Well, Addison, please.
May it please the court, Keith Hunt on behalf of the appellants, 14 displaced workers from Commonwealth Edison. I'd like to start by making clear what we believe this case is about. This case was filed as a test case. This case was filed in the Illinois courts seeking a declaration by the Illinois courts and a recognition that there is an implied private right of action under the Illinois Electric Service and Rate Relief Law. This was not filed in the federal court. It was not filed as a Section 301 case or pursuant to the Labor Management Relations Act or any other federal statute. The ESCRL that's cited in the brief specifically was enacted to protect utility workers in Illinois when it became apparent that utilities such as Commonwealth Edison were considering merging with out-of-state utilities and that there was a likelihood that Illinois workers could be displaced. As a result, the Illinois legislature enacted this statute, and specifically in the text of the statute articulated the public policy that they were advocating and the evils that they were attempting to protect Illinois workers from. They were trying to protect competition and make sure that Illinois workers were not displaced as a result of this merger. We filed this case and the defendants removed the case to federal court, and we filed a motion for remand, which was denied, and the complaint was dismissed at that time, which is what brings us to the present appeal. The Supreme Court, the Seventh Circuit, and all of the other courts to consider this issue have pretty well clarified the law in this area. Section 301 only preempts if you have to interpret the collective bargaining agreement. The fact that there is a collective bargaining agreement or that the workers are covered by a union does not mean that their rights, as guaranteed under Illinois law, are somehow preempted or trumped by the existence of the federal statute. The courts that have looked at this, and Lingle talked about it and said, just because the collective bargaining agreement has useful information that may be used in resolving the worker's claim does not then mean that their claim is preempted. Similarly, in Alice Chalmers, the United States Supreme Court said that just because that not every dispute tangentially involving a provision of the collective bargaining agreement necessarily means that there's a preemption. And in Leviticus, the Supreme Court said, just because the collective bargaining agreement may be useful in determining the value of the plaintiff's claim or what the amount in controversy is, does not mean that the claim is preempted. In this situation, I think the ultimate test is, can the plaintiff, if the Illinois courts were to imply a private right of action under the Electric Service Rate Relief Law, would a court, would a judge or a jury have to look at the case, look at the collective bargaining agreement, and interpret what it means to determine the outcome of the case? And I submit that we can prove that entire case and that we can prove all of the damages in that case without ever introducing the collective bargaining agreement into evidence.
How are you going to deal with what the terms and conditions of employment are? You'd have to be able to do that, wouldn't you?
But not from the collective bargaining agreement, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because we know through testimony and through other human resource type documents what the terms and conditions of those employment were. We know what positions these people held. They can testify to that. There's going to be personnel records that say that Perry Tift worked in a particular position while he was at ComEd. And the same for all the other workers.
There's like things like seniority. Is that covered by the collective bargaining agreement, determining seniority?
seniority may be covered by the collective bargaining agreement, but that's not an element of the cause of action that we've asserted, and it's not something that we would need to prove in order to prevail in the case. Because what we need to prove is that they were displaced. It doesn't matter whether, for purposes of our case, whether ComEd went to the top of the stack or the bottom, the people with the most seniority or the least seniority. The rate relief law says you can't fire these people, and you have to, under our construction of the rate relief law, that you need to protect their employment for a period of 30 months.
Suppose the collective bargaining agreement has a layoff provision in it.
It may. And it may be, as, for example, this court was confronted with in the Merzuki case or in the Schmidt case, that a worker may have a right to pursue a grievance pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement.
How about
that is not control.
How about severance pay?
Severance pay may well be determined by that. The point here, though,
and
is that they're entitled to...
Then wouldn't you have to introduce it to show them?
If we were claiming severance pay as the element of damage, but we're not. What we're claiming is, I mean, why take severance pay when you can get back wages? I mean, the claim here is that they have lost now approximately 2 years' worth of salary and worth of their health care protection and all of the other things that they would normally get on a biweekly basis when they're paid. That's
the
what
company says, on the other hand, we laid them off because we had to.
And then that gets into the issue of whether
what their cause was.
I'm sorry?
They'd have to prove what their cause was and have to get into the seniority question, wouldn't they?
They may, but as this court noticed
from that is severance.
I'm sorry?
And following from that is severance.
But that's their defense. And as the Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit have previously recognized, the fact that a defendant raises the collective bargaining agreement as part of their defense does not control the issue of whether 301 preempts. It's the plaintiff's claim, not how they choose to defend the case, that controls. And in this case, all we need to show is that they were workers that were entitled to be protected by the statute, that they were within the class of persons designed to be protected, that their injury, being terminated or displaced, was one that the statute was designed to protect, that a private right of action is consistent with the purpose of that statute, and that implying a right is necessary to provide an adequate remedy for the violation for them. Now, that's what the Fisher case from the Illinois Supreme Court held. That's the four-step test that Fisher used to determine whether Illinois courts are going to imply a private right of action.
There's no Illinois court has implied a right of action under the statute, has it?
That's correct. At the time we filed this case, our research did not reveal any case that had ever been decided under this statute. This was going to be a case of first impression, which is why we filed it in the Illinois courts, so that it could go up through the Illinois appellate chain and ultimately to the Supreme Court of Illinois, who has decided Kelsey and all the other cases in which they imply private rights of action.
Suppose we were to decide that there is no implied right of action in the state statute. Do you still have a case?
Frankly, no. But we believe that that decision, respectfully, is better made by the Illinois courts so that they can determine exactly what they want the public policy to be with respect to these state law wrongful discharge claims. You look at the Illinois courts, Kelsey, all of its progeny, and we look at what the Seventh Circuit has decided in the cases that we cited in the brief, Getsky, Westerbrook, Marzuki, Coles Foods. These are all retaliatory discharge cases that have been decided and are held not to be preempted. And that's what we have. We didn't go under public policy, we went under a statute, but it is a retaliatory discharge case.
What do we do now, Mr. Hunt? We're in the second level of federal courts, and we don't know what the state statute means. You haven't filed a motion to certify, have you?
No, what we did is we filed a motion for remand to get it back into the Illinois courts. We believe the appropriate remedy from the Seventh Circuit is to remand the cause to the district court with instructions to remand the cause of action to the Circuit Court of Cook County for further proceedings.
May I ask you just one other question? And with respect to the statute itself, it talks about the same conditions of employment, etc., and then says, unless the parties mutually agree to different terms. Who are the parties for purposes of that clause?
That's a good question. I believe Commonwealth Edison would argue that it's the union and the management, and we would assert that in this case it was PICO and Commonwealth Edison, the parties to the merger agreement, because what it talks about is in the event of a sale, purchase, or transfer of ownership, the only parties that are even contemplated in the transaction that this specific provision is speaking about is, nowhere in here do they mention the union. Okay, what they're talking about is the generating units, which the power plant, and the two entities that are buying or selling those units. And there's been no evidence in this record that anywhere in the contract for sale or any of the closing documents there was any special deal cut between PICO and Commonwealth Edison.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Jim Weiss here on behalf of Appellees Exelon.
Counsel, why shouldn't we remand this case to the Illinois courts if it's a matter of Illinois law?
Well, it isn't a matter of Illinois law. It is a matter of federal law under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act. As we have pointed out, and as this Court has recognized, in fact, in the Sluder decision, I believe, among others, written by Judge Kaney, the artful pleading doctrine does not allow a plaintiff to avoid federal jurisdiction simply by avoiding using the terms of a federal statute in their complaint. Plaintiffs do not mention federal statutes in their complaint, but the Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized, as has this Court, that the sweeping scope of preemption under Section 301 merits preemption even where there's no obvious federal claim on the face of the complaint. And the law is, as counsel has recognized, is fairly well settled. If, in order to resolve a claim, you need to interpret a collective bargaining agreement, refer to interpret a collective bargaining agreement, then in order to preserve the federal interest, the overriding federal interest in maintaining a uniform body of federal labor law, then federal laws will apply and the claim is treated as if it was federal from the outset. And that is certainly the case with respect to the plaintiff's claims today. As the members of the panel have pointed out, it would be impossible to resolve the claims under the statute as it is written without looking at the collective bargaining agreements and other agreements.
You have to look at it, but would you have, you have to interpret it? Why would you have to interpret it?
Well, in a number of different ways. The statute itself sets forth various requirements on employers. Incidentally, nowhere does the statute say that employees may not be laid off. That has been the plaintiff's claim from the beginning here, that the statute simply prohibits a layoff during a 30-month period. But the statute, in the sections applicable to utility employees, expressly recognizes that layoffs may occur. And in fact, what the statute does is it says, okay, recognizing that reasonably anticipatable effect of deregulation will be that some employees may be displaced, we want you to put measures into effect that will mitigate the effects of that. So there's two sections in the statute that apply. One essentially applies in the event of reductions in force, simply without any transfer of ownership. And there the statute says that before any such reduction in the workforce during the transition period, which is defined in the statute, an electric utility shall present to its employees or their representatives a workforce reduction plan outlining the means by which the electric utility intends to mitigate the impact of such workforce reduction on its employees. So they're directing the utilities to present a workforce reduction plan to the employees or their representatives, in other words, the union, regarding such measures as severance, and this is identified specifically in the statute, voluntary severance, retraining, early retirement, outplacement, and related benefits. If the plaintiff's claim was that the ComEd violated this section of the statute, and they're never clear on what section it is that ComEd supposedly violated, in part because they would like to assert that there's an absolute ban on layoffs. But if this is the statute that's applicable, you're going to have to look and see what was this workforce reduction plan. Was it presented to the union? Did they work something out? Was it, in fact, violated? And interestingly, there is an agreement specifically addressing these points in the record. It was one of the exhibits to our opposition to the motion to remand. But there's a utility agreement that between ComEd and the other Illinois utilities and their IBEW local that lays out what minimum severance requirements will be and talked about tuition reimbursement and so forth. You couldn't evaluate whether this obligation set forth in the statute was met without looking at that agreement and the other agreements between the parties.
What exactly is the obligation here? It says it'll continue for 30 months.
That's in Section C, Your Honor.
Yeah, almost, that's right. Suppose the CBA expires in 12 months. Does this statute purport to extend the CBA until 30 months have elapsed?
No, it does not, Your Honor. It states unless the parties agree otherwise, and the terms and conditions of employment, which is a term of art that's set forth in Section 8D of the National Labor Relations Act, those terms and conditions must be continued before and after the sale. It's another point at which you're going to have to, in Section C, which applies in the event of a transfer of ownership,
mm-hmm.
There the employees, a sufficient number must be offered employment at not less than the current wages with similar fringe benefits, and then with terms and conditions continuing from before and after.
What does this subsection give that the employees did not previously have?
What it provides in part is it provides the guarantee that a selling entity is going to enter into an agreement with a purchasing entity that the purchasing entity will hire a sufficient number of the non-supervisory employees
mm-hmm.
from the seller.
Mm-hmm.
That under normal labor law would not be required.
Yeah.
It also states that for those employees who are not offered jobs, the utility will offer a transition plan. That's another negotiated plan, and it has to be negotiated. These are all mandatory subjects of bargaining. If they're represented employees, that has to be negotiated with the union.
Mm-hmm.
So again, those are not, absent this statute, those requirements wouldn't be there. So it does add those requirements, but those are requirements that in order to resolve the claim, you would have to look back and see what exactly was agreed to between the union and the parties here are clearly
would
the union and the
successor employer be bound by the old CBA?
This is that the successor employer will continue the terms and conditions of employment. It would not necessarily mean actual assumption of the bargaining agreement, and it also allows the parties to reach alternative agreements.
But my point is, would the successor employer under federal labor law be bound by the old CBA?
No, a successor employer under federal labor law would have the opportunity to set their own terms and conditions.
So we're not talking about a contemporary agreement here, are we? We're talking, in other words, you're going to be referencing the old agreement.
You're going to need to compare the old agreement with the new agreement to see what the terms, whether the terms
if
in order.
If there is a new agreement.
Right.
It may not be.
Well, as a factual matter, there is. It's not in the record, but there have been negotiations and new agreements since then.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, that's right.
So we're not interfering with an ongoing collective bargaining agreement arrangement necessarily, are we? This statute doesn't necessarily interfere with an ongoing collective bargaining arrangement.
No, because the statute allows the parties to agree, to reach agreement on new terms and conditions.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the collective bargaining relationship of the employer and employees, what does this subsection give that then? Still have the right to negotiate a new CBA.
Yes.
And that new CBA can change the conditions of employment. Am I correct?
Yes, it can.
So what do they get, really, from this?
The employees?
Yeah.
Well,
outside of I understand the transition, the fight to be hired, the transition
plan.
I understand that.
All of that.
But with respect to the collective bargaining arrangement between employee
for
and employer,
employees,
yeah, what does it give them that they won't already have under federal labor law?
What they get is, it's through their bargaining representative.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to them directly, but what they get is number one, an assurance that upon the transfer of ownership. The acquiring entity will determine the sufficient number of employees that it needs, the non-supervisory employees, and we'll draw that from the previous workforce.
Right.
That's certainly a major job security.
So you got a job. Now you got the job.
You got a job.
Now you're going to deal with your employer.
Right.
And my question is, what do you get by virtue of the Illinois statute that you don't have by virtue of the federal labor law?
What you would get is, first of all, the presumption that terms and conditions of employment will continue following the sale. The wages, benefits, and all other terms and conditions of employment will continue.
Unless renegotiated.
Unless renegotiated. But if it's renegotiated, of course, that means that it is by agreement with their representative. So that is something that they should be, if not okay with, or at least that they've delegated that role to the union. Mm-hmm. So,
what do you, if I may, just, because we've spent a lot of time scratching our heads on this wording, what does it mean here when it talks about the parties mutually agreeing? Who are those parties, according to your view?
I think those parties necessarily have to be the union representing the employees and the utility, because any agreement on terms and conditions of employment would have to be between the union under federal labor law. PICO and ComEd could not make an agreement and simply impose it on the workforce. Mm-hmm.
Proceed.
All right. Well, I think we've, you know, covered the most of our points here. I think that it's simply in the complaint itself, which is far away from what the where we currently are. But in the complaint itself, they say that they're wanting to apply a statute different than the one that's actually enacted. And I commend to the court the Hughes case in the Sixth Circuit, which we cite in our brief as an illustration of where an appeals court is by no means bound by an inaccurate reading of a state statute. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have no more time, counsel. I'll give you half a minute.
Thank you. Two very brief points. First of all, to the issue of parties, if you read the entire Section C, talks about a contract, an agreement between the purchasing utility and the selling utility. Those are the only two parties that are mentioned in there. It's the utilities that they're talking about when they enacted that section. Secondly, the statute does prevent layoffs because by guaranteeing the continued terms and conditions of employment for 30 months, that is very similar to what this court has recognized in the context of retaliation cases, whether there's been a materially adverse employment action, whether the terms and conditions have been altered, and all the cases say when you take somebody's job away, it's a material adverse employment action, you've altered the terms or conditions of their employment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. We will proceed to case number 4, please.